for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very pleased that we can begin today's morning show with two very special guests from the Hospice Alliance of Kenosha. Rita Hagen and Rita... And Christy Barfield. And they're going to be with us today to talk about the extraordinary difference that hospice care can make in the lives of people who find themselves approaching the end of life. We'll be talking about the decision that somebody needs to make to place a person, or for a person themselves to place themselves into hospice care, and the difference that it can make in terms of the way life ends. And it's timely that Rita and Christy can join us today, because there is a special event coming up this Thursday, which can help people sort of begin thinking about some of these issues maybe in a new way that they have not thought about them before. And they also have a couple of new programs that are about to get underway that we're excited to talk about as well. Rita Hagen is the executive director there, and Christy Barfield is education manager. And we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. I'm so glad we can have this conversation. I want to preface our conversation by telling a quick little personal story. I think it was maybe 2 years ago now, 2.5 years ago, that somebody that I knew fairly well, but not super well, passed away somewhat suddenly, and it was something I was sad to hear about. He was a very faithful listener to the morning show, and I knew him through a couple of other avenues as well. But again, not a particularly close friend, but somebody I certainly liked and admired. When his son came to his home, while this gentleman was yet in the hospital, he was directed to look for a CD on the kitchen table. And he went and found this and put on this CD, not knowing what it was. And here, track one was a morning show that this gentleman had listened to. And it was an interview I had done with the author of a book called The Conversation, and a book in which he offered up some thoughts on how one can have these sometimes uncomfortable conversations with somebody about the way they want their life to end. So that was track one of this CD. And track two was the voice of this man spelling out his wishes for how he wanted life to end. And it was very, very sobering and humbling to think that a morning show conversation had perhaps made a difference in the decisions that this particular gentleman had made. But I suspect that in many, many cases that has not occurred, and that families often find themselves in really difficult circumstances trying to figure out what exactly to do. Can we just begin there with the importance of having conversations? Because I know the screening of this documentary on Thursday is a very important theme.
I think that you hit the nail on the head, in that having the conversation
the earlier you can have the conversation, the easier it's going to be for families and for each of us. I think that, you know, statistically speaking, 100% of us will die. And so although that's true, the conversation is so difficult often to bring up to family. Certainly it's going to be easier when you're not in the emotional moment of having to make some really difficult decisions. So my children kind of tease me, growing up with a mom as a hospice nurse, this was table talk at our house for many, many years. And I think that if we can somehow normalize those conversations so that they're not taboo, but they're just a part, as much as we talk about the joy of a baby coming or anticipating that, that we can talk about it as part of a natural part of the life cycle. What do we anticipate? What would we like? How would we like our last days to be? Who would we like to see? Who's important to us? What would we like to do? What do we need to say? Certainly, I'd encourage people to say those things earlier than later.
I think when you were telling that story, the first thing that came to my head was, what an amazing gift to that son. That the dad had that insight to take that time to say all those things, because it is such an emotional time. He's declining, doing poorly, and here all the answers that he needed were on this tape.
Right.
And so I think that's just a wonderful gift you can give somebody, because that is a tough time. And so when you are kind of put unexpectedly or whatever into that situation, if you've had that conversation with your family, it's amazing, because then you're really just following through with their wishes.
Right, and you don't have on your own shoulders the mantle of responsibility to try to figure out what they want or would have wanted. I mean, if they, God forbid, are not in a position to be able to express that at that point. I suppose that's the thing that so often occurs, is the conversation is delayed to the point where it ends up never happening, and then loved ones are left with very, very difficult choices, and they don't know if they're reflecting the wishes that person might have had. So towards that end, just before we forget then, explain to our listeners the screening that's going to be happening on Thursday night, which really helps, we hope, spark people to have these conversations.
Well, it's at the Kenosha Public Museum. It's the screening of Being Mortal, which is a documentary through PBS on a book written by Atul Gawande that was titled Being Mortal. And it really talks about his journey as a physician and how his views had changed. And it really was sparked by when his father became ill with a serious illness, and that whole becoming now the caretaker and a physician. And he kind of watched the things that happened to his dad in the medical system and then realized the role he had played with others and kind of doing the same thing. And so it really is a great way for the medical community and people to know how to have those conversations, make your wishes known.
Well, and I think, too, much as as we said earlier about leaving those wishes for your family, having those honest conversations with your healthcare providers is equally as important. The treatments that they're going to offer, the direction that they're going to kind of show you, is really going to be influenced by how you feel and how you see your final days. I think that part of what this documentary talked about, too, was the difficulty sometimes that the medical community has in bringing up end-of-life issues. Historically, I think that death has been seen as a failure. And you know, I think that instead of it being a natural part of life and expected outcome for each of us, and how we want to see those days, how we want our treatment to match our wishes, I think is important. So I think it empowers people to have the conversations with the physicians, even if the physicians aren't ready to have it with you.
Sometimes it's up to you to be very proactive with that.
Right. Be your own advocate.
Yeah. I want to say that I had the great honor of speaking with Atul Gawande on this program almost 10 years ago, talking about what might have been his very first book called Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance. And it's a superb book, and he's written several, and I think Being Mortal is his most recent. So he is a very, very eloquent and heartfelt physician, and it excites me very much to know that this program is going to be shared with the public. So again, that is at 6:30 this Thursday, September 7th, at the Kenosha Public Museum, a screening sponsored by the Hospice Alliance of Kenosha. For those of you just joining us, we have two representatives of Hospice Alliance with us today, Executive Director Rita Hagen and Education Manager Christy Barfield. So a lot of people know the word hospice, but there is probably a clear definition of it that is probably important for us to spell out. And maybe in talking about what hospice care exactly is, we can also talk about a term that is relatively similar but not exactly the same thing, namely palliative care. So let's draw a distinction there, but begin with hospice care.
Well, I think what makes hospice care unique really is the team. It's an interdisciplinary team of professionals that look at the same problem, but each through a different lens. There's the RN case manager, the social worker, the chaplain, and the hospice medical director. And we work collaboratively with the care providers that are already in place. So your attending physician or a nurse practitioner, whomever you see. I think that's what makes hospice care unique. Certainly the fact that it is at end of life. Two physicians, both your attending physician and our hospital, our hospice medical director, have to agree that your prognosis is 6 months or less. And having said that, then, the focus of care, of course, really turns towards patient goals. And that interdisciplinary team does an excellent job, again, of seeing each of these goals through a different lens and really supporting patients and family and how we can provide the care that's going to support those goals through those final days.
And then palliative care is really the piece before hospice care and can start for years before that. If you have any type of serious illness that's been diagnosed, whether that's heart failure or pulmonary disease of some sort, renal failure, we can provide palliative care by helping work with your regular physicians and that team and avoiding hospitalizations, giving you the best quality of life long before you're even thinking about end of life, but really giving you time to watch your meds, watch your diet, do all those things that are important, giving you that little extra help, and again, keeping you out of the hospital, which gives you a better quality of life.
So if I understand correctly, palliative care to a large extent is about making a patient feel better. I mean, dealing with their discomfort, with their pain, whatever that may be, and perhaps focusing less on trying to end the disease or cure the disease. I mean, so are we talking in a case with palliative care where it is a situation that cannot be cured, or is it just that curing the condition or ending the condition is a lower priority than the patient's comfort?
I think typically with palliative care, you think of chronic diseases. So you know we're not going to cure the disease, we're not going to fix the disease. sometimes treatment options are a little broader at the beginning of palliative care. Hospice is actually a form of palliative care. It's just the final stage of palliative care. And sometimes we get that backwards a little bit. So you think of hospice and palliative care, but it really should be palliative care and hospice. we're just those final days. But certainly palliative care, the focus is on quality of life. And again, sometimes there's broader treatment options. Often by the time you come to a hospice, some of the treatment options are not really going to be relevant anymore.
So we're to a certain stage by that point then.
Right.
So when someone steps from palliative care into hospice care, I mean, there is this threshold of 6 months. So typically at that point, what happens to the patient in terms of the kind of care that they receive? And is it true essentially across the board? Is pretty much hospice care largely the same for each and every patient?
No, I think the beauty of hospice care is that it is designed uniquely around that particular patient and their goals for end of life. And those goals can be, I mean, just all over the board. Sometimes they're I just want to be comfortable. I don't want any pain. I want to stay in my home. I don't want, obviously, to be hospitalized, but I want to stay here. And sometimes it's a little more complicated. I need you to help me do the best you can because my daughter's getting married in the fall, and that's my goal, is to get to my daughter's wedding. And we don't perform magic, but we do what we can to keep them healthy, to meet their needs, so that, honestly, taking some of that stress off of a family and off the patient makes a huge difference in allowing them. And sometimes people on hospice actually live a little bit longer than what they were originally predicted because of the fact that hospice eliminates a lot of those stressors. That being a caretaker isn't easy, and when you're a patient at end of life, you see that stress you're kind of putting on that family, and it's bothersome. And I think when we can step in and help them out, it makes a big difference.
Interesting. So sometimes the physical well-being of the the patient is really even enhanced beyond what we might directly expect from hospice.
Right. And it's when Christy said about those our circle of care team, each of them playing a role in that. So maybe someone isn't religious, but they're spiritual, and our chaplain can help them find what things they need to put them at ease before they die. And our social worker helping to make sure things are all in a row. Or maybe it's helping with a family and kind of healing things and mending fences, as they say. And then our nurse, obviously, is kind of overseeing all of that and then making sure their physical health is the best it can be to keep them comfortable, keep them safe.
And then to add to that, we have, of course, complementary therapy, our wonderful home health aides, CNAs, volunteers. They're a huge part of the hospice program and provide tremendous support and do things that are just wonderful in adding quality of life for our patients.
Right. So when somebody begins hospice care, how often are they in the hospital? I mean, is that most commonly the situation, that somebody has been hospitalized with an illness or a disease, and it's to the point then where, no, it looks like hospice is what we should do? Or quite often are people still, in a sense, walking about but living with a terminal illness, and the determination is made that the end is relatively near? How often do we see each of those scenarios?
Well, I think we see them all. I think all of them are common. Basically, anyone can refer themselves or ask their physician for a referral to hospice. Sometimes folks, that comes after a hospitalization or during a hospitalization, when conversations and, again, treatment choices change. Sometimes they're in nursing homes. Sometimes they're at home in assisted living. And things are just starting to change. Often it's, I think, a need for increased care starts to happen. And sometimes it's symptom management. I think the best kept secret about hospice is that we are experts at pain and symptom management. And I think that sometimes we don't get those referrals as early as the patient could benefit, because I think we're thought of more so as, the death benefit. And,
right.
You know, that you call people when you're ready to die. That's
right.
When you need hospice.
And it's hand-holding as much
exactly,
as anything. Not
right.
That's not important.
Exactly. But I think, certainly everyone benefits more if we can be in place to anticipate those symptoms and anticipate those needs as things begin to change at end of life. And again, the best kept secret is that we are experts at pain and symptom management. And certainly for us to be able to do our best for you, sometimes a little extra time, and getting to know you, getting to know what your goals are, getting to know what you wish. Some people want to have zero pain. Some people don't want to have zero pain. Some people want to die alone. Some people don't want to die alone. And that's important for us to have an idea of who you are and how you want those things to be, for us to provide that care in the best way.
How often are patients at your beautiful facility on Highway 50 on the south side of Kenosha versus in their own home? What would you say the numerical breakdown is there?
Well, we only have 8 beds, so that there limits the amount of people. But really what we use our hospice house for. It's considered a residential facility, and it's really for lots of reasons, but mostly for people who are in their own personal homes. And maybe it's that they're both elderly, and the spouse that's taking care of our patient at end of life has her own or his own needs and are unable to care for that patient any longer. Perhaps it's a younger woman. We had a wonderful family who had wanted her to end her life at her, you know, end of life at home, but then had second thoughts. She had young children and was concerned about them remembering that mom passed away in those rooms. So there's really lots of reasons that we use our hospice house. So it's probably our smaller percentage, just simply in the fact that it's only 8 beds. And they usually transfer in when they're really at end of life, when we're just trying to really meet the needs of the caretaker and the patient. And again, it's one of those situations where you just see a patient that just the stress, you know what I mean? They just relax fully because they know people can then just be daughters and wives and, you know, and not the caretaker.
Right.
Well, certainly our hospice house is a jewel, and it truly is, and we're really proud of it. I think that the majority of hospice care and the hospice benefit was really designed to bring care to the patients. And so that's wherever they are. And, again, nursing homes, assisted living, their private residences, hospitals, wherever people need hospice care, we bring the team, which is a little different from the rest of the medical community, where patients go to the care. And I think what it does when we bring care to them, it really establishes that power. When they are still in their own home, they're still their own decision maker. We're always guests in their home. And I think that really establishes that sense of power and balance in the right way,
and gives them some sort of control at a time in their life where they really have very little.
Exactly.
Right. So when someone is receiving hospice care in their home, typically then what does that look like, and how often is somebody there, and typically how is that schedule in a sense crafted or constructed?
Well, hospice is not designed to take away caregiver. The necessity for a caregiver. We just add care to what's already in place. So if they're in their home, there needs to often be a caregiver available. And then the hospice services support and empower the people that are providing care, whether it's a facility or at home. So typically the nurse makes the visit at least once a week, but it's really based on patient need. So if things are going well and, you know, our expert pain and symptom management is as it should be, perhaps a weekly visit is enough to check in, make sure things are – we feel really good when everything's going so well and our folks don't need us. That's a good sign. So they can be out doing the things that they want to do, spend their energy with family, those kinds of things. Certainly as things change, we increase those visits to meet the need of the individual. And then the same with the rest of the team, our social workers and chaplains, depending upon what the need is, our home health aides in particular, probably our patients see them the most, as well as volunteers and the complementary therapists. Sometimes the need is greater for the chaplain. Sometimes the need is greater for our complementary therapists. So that's how we work. We work as a team, and we really tailor how often they see us according to what the need is.
Interesting. How about when you are coming into a facility, a hospital or a nursing home, where there is already trained staff in place? How does hospice operate within those circumstances? And I'm especially curious to know if that's ever potentially tricky or awkward, or does that create sensitive situations even beyond the patient themselves, in which you need to step in and do your work and yet probably don't want to seem like you're stepping in and taking over, for instance. So how are those situations typically handled?
Well, it really is collaborative, the relationship, whatever the facility is. You have to work together. That team who's had that patient understands that patient. We come in. Or if we had the patient and somehow they end up in one of those facilities, you know, we have to work with them to tell them what we know. So you really, it is a full collaboration. It can be difficult, not due to anything more than, you know, if they're in a facility, they're with them more. They spend more time with them. So it's important for our team in hospice to make sure you respect that and you look at that and that knowledge that those people have for this person that we're caring for together and working together. Our care plans have to match. We don't want one of theirs and one of ours because that's not going to benefit the patient. So we get involved. We'll have conferences if they're in a facility or whatever. We'll work with the team in the hospital. And it can be, like I said, either way. Sometimes we're called in. Most of the time we're called in. But I
think collaboration and communication are really the key words. Certainly, we don't replace what they do. And when you think about, I think perhaps a nursing home is an easier situation to think about the things that they do, the cares that they provide. They would still continue to provide those cares. At the end of life, there's extra needs, and so hospice provides extra care to meet those needs, kind of that specialty in end of life. The nursing homes in particular, their focus is more restorative. And we know at end of life that those goals are going to change. And so that's where we bring the expertise and partner with our nursing home partners to provide that end of life care.
So what is typically the moment then if someone ends up moving to your hospice house, what typically is the reason for that sort of a move? And how often does that happen? I mean, quite often do people end up actually passing away in the nursing home or their own home?
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's really the goal. They want to pass away in their own home. That's probably the one goal that the most have in common. Right. And that being whether it's the nursing home they've been in for 10 years or the assisted living that they've been in.
That is their home.
That's their home. And so that is what we try and do. When we do transfer into our hospice house, it's not that it wouldn't come from one of those facilities, because it has. During that conversation of the two teams talking, and everyone on both sides feels it would be beneficial. But most of the time, they're either admitted directly to the hospice house from a hospital, or their home, either not being on hospice prior, or they're one of our hospice patients, you know, an established patient, and their needs have just, or the family becomes concerned, or it becomes difficult or emotional for them to care for that patient at that time. And then
caregiver breakdown or caregiver fatigue can be a reason.
Yes.
Symptom management, where things just are becoming overwhelming for the patient's family to provide those kinds of
cares. If they can't provide comfort, you know, from pain, then we put them in where we have a nurse around the clock that we can help with that. But we've been able to do that in a home as well. We can do continuous care, and we can get nurses there and spend time to help give those medications a little more often or deal with that symptom that is creating them such problems.
As a short-term solution.
Right.
And then from there, we look as to where is going to be the most appropriate place for this person to receive if they need a 24-hour skilled care.
We're speaking with Rita Hagen and Christy Barfield, who are with Hospice Alliance. And, of course, many of you have at least some awareness of what Hospice Alliance is and the significant difference that it can make for someone who is approaching the end of life, what a difference it makes in their life and in the life of everybody around them who loves them and is caring for them. And one of the things that you said, Christy, is that sometimes we do not appreciate the expertise that hospice caregivers have when it comes to the management of pain. Can you just say a word about some of the choices that might confront a family about how to deal with this and how you help a family through some of those choices that confront them?
Well, we know as people especially get closer and closer to death, things change. Body systems begin to change. They're in bed even more. So often we talk a lot about pain and symptom management, and the reason we do is that 70 to 90% of the people we care for have pain. So that's why we talk about it so much. in hospice care, because we deal with it so much, I think that we are sensitive to it and obviously have the expertise in managing it. Not only in managing it, but I think teaching other caregivers how to manage it and supporting them through that process. You know, for most people, they do not want to die in pain. And I think that when people talk about some of their fears at end of life, that's one of them.
Right.
They don't want to die in pain. And I think we can all understand and appreciate that. And so if we can come in and say, listen, you know, we can work with you if you're honest with us and you tell us exactly what you're feeling and what's working. We might not get it right away, but we're going to keep working until we do. And I think that assurance really helps minimize some of those fears, too.
Right. I wonder sometimes if one of the choices that a patient and their family face is some sort of trade-off between management of pain and mental and emotional clarity. The fact that sometimes when you pump someone full of something that is going to take their pain away, it also is going to take some of their awareness away, which in some cases might be a kind of a secondary blessing in disguise, I suppose, but something that certain people really might not want. I mean, that they really do not want to let go of their own mental acuity any quicker than it's going to be just taken away from them by kind of the circumstances of life. Is that one decision or choice that has to be made?
Always. And I think, you know, a lot of that goes with the education. And certainly I would want to be clear. I would want to be with my loved ones and know that I was with them until the final moments of my life. So if that's, and others, not so much. Other people do ask to be sleepy. And so, again, those are the conversations and the honesty that we have. If pain management is done effectively and in the correct way, we can indeed manage pain and balance that with clarity. I think sometimes at end of life, what happens is that pain medicine often gets blamed for the natural dying process. As people die, they become sleepier. They sleep more and more, and that's often a part of their natural process, and sometimes dependent upon the disease that they're suffering from. But we need to be mindful that sometimes, whether they're medicated or not, they might be sleepy. But yes, absolutely, those are when we talk about goals and goals of care, those are some of the goals that we are really clear about when we're working with our patients and families, to kind of know where that balance is or what the trade-off might be.
Right. Rita Hagen, is hospice care ever an exercise in a sense, hastening death?
No, never. It is really just about providing that additional support at end of life, but it is not about hastening death.
Is death, in a sense, hastened inadvertently? I don't mean accidentally, but in the service of some of these other goals that a patient might have, in effect, is death hastened in a sense, or not forestalled? Maybe it might be another way to put it.
Yeah, actually, the studies show the opposite, is that people, I think it's live an 25 days longer than what they had normally, say, predicted for that patient because of the relief, the support, the care that hospice brings to both the caregivers and the patient. So, you know, our goal isn't to prolong life either. It's just the natural consequence of providing those things and making it easier for families. And we always include the families, because the families are such a huge part of that, and it affects the patient, you know, the guilt the patient feels for having them need to provide their care. So our support is geared to both of them.
Interesting. Do you ever find that you are fielding requests from patients that they, in a sense, are ready to be done, I mean, and wish to die? Is this a request that is often made of hospice, that hospice in a sense is not in a position to deliver, or does hospice care typically negate any of those wishes by making the end of life more tolerable than it would otherwise be.
I think it's important to remember that we neither hasten death nor prolong life. Mm-hmm. And I also think that there's a difference between someone who says that they're ready to die and someone that requests help in dying.
Mm.
I think that there are two huge differences.
Right. Yeah.
First of all, physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia is not legal in the state of Wisconsin. So that pretty much ends the discussion right there. But I think the big question, if somebody were to ask that, is why? And typically there are fears that are behind that question. And if we address those fears, I think then there may be value in living their life through the dying process. And that's what I think hospice focuses on. And when often that's achieved when we have good pain and symptom management. And certainly that's where the advantage of this interdisciplinary team that we've been talking about really comes into play. You know, it's hard to talk about quality of life or goals of care if you're in pain. So when we can address that, then our social workers and our chaplains can kind of sometimes address some of the other issues that come behind those questions.
Because it's the supporting, not just the physical care, but the emotional and the psychological care that is so important. And by doing that, as Christy said, I think that changes really someone's outlook on end of life and how they can approach it and help them approach it.
And even hopefully seeing value in the process.
Right, right. What about the matter of physicians and their attitudes about hospice care? I don't want to get too specific, but I have heard this a lot, that there are plenty of medical doctors out there, and I think you've yourself have said it in the course of this conversation, medical doctors out there in the world that really are reluctant to relinquish the battle against whatever the disease in question is, and they see the turning over of a patient to hospice care as some sort of surrender, acquiescence to a foe that they would rather battle right to the end. And I suspect that maybe a few years ago that was probably a more common attitude. Are we seeing less of that now? Do you by and large see most physicians as sympathetic to what hospice is all about?
There are some wonderful physicians who get it and understand it and can help a family, and they call us in right away. And there are still some that struggle, but I think to their defense, their entire education, all their years of schooling, it was always geared to saving a life. And so when you don't save a life, it's a failure on their part, and that's not what they do. So they have the absolute best intention always for the patient. But I think where you're starting to slowly see a change that will make things better is now medical schools are addressing end-of-life care. Nursing schools started earlier, and they have been addressing it. So us nurses can, I always say, like in my big fat Greek wedding, they can be the neck and they can turn the head to help a family get to there and then approach a physician to say. So they're trying. They are trying. I think this screening on Thursday tells that. There's an excellent surgeon, a wonderful physician who cared for hundreds and hundreds of patients, and it took a personal situation in his life to realize that he was telling patients everything was going to be okay, even though he knew everything wasn't going to be okay.
Right.
And so they're getting there. They're getting there. And I think as we as hospice can work with our physicians in our communities more, that helps as well. We develop those relationships so that they learn to trust us and our decisions and our, you know, reports that we give them. And we want them to stay involved to end of life, because that's what's important to the family. It's not that we come in and take over, but we continue to work with them.
Right, right. I think one of the reasons, one of the ways in which I became really convinced that there's still a bit of an issue with some medical doctors is hearing about situations in which somebody was finally, in a sense, turned over to hospice care and passed away two or three days later. And I think you were saying before we went on the air that that's really not the ideal way to utilize hospice. Hospice should not be there for your dying last breaths. Hospice should be there for, ideally, for more of this journey, right?
Well, certainly we will be there if you call us in those final 2 days. We certainly will be there for you. But I think that the benefit of having our team in place earlier, first of all, we know the individual and we know the family. As Rita said, we consider the patient and family a unit of care. And our services continue for a year after the death as far as bereavement. So we mean it when we say that it is a unit of care. And certainly if we have a relationship that lasts a little bit longer, that's better for everybody involved. And I think certainly we're able to provide better pain and symptom management and prepare the families better if we have a little more time together.
Sure.
And I think when we started this program this morning, we talked about the conversations. And I think that is really the ultimate. If we can all be better about talking to our loved ones about our wishes at end of life, that may keep us from that hospitalization. That may keep us from those treatments and all kinds of treatments at that. And our families understand why we don't want to do that. And if you begin that conversation, like Christy said, early with her family, because our goals for life when I'm 40 and raising my family are far different than my
Absolutely.
Goals now that I'm nearing 60 and I have grandchildren, but my family's raised. You know, so your goals are going to change as we age and what we want. And I think if you have those goals, then your family, when you can't talk or along supporting you, can say to a physician, I don't want that. That's not what I want. I want to be home enjoying my family, being with my grandchildren as long as I possibly can. You know, if I'm going to be get those treatments and live a year, am I going to be sick for 9 months of that year or 2 months of that year? That's what people need to hear, because nobody wants to die, but we want to know what our options are.
Right.
And so the more educated all of us are, the more we talk about it, the more we tell the community to talk about it, then they can be their own advocates and bring up the conversations if you happen to have a physician who struggles with end-of-life conversations.
Right.
Well, and I think the word advocate is perfect. And I think, and a little bit, consumer. You know, if you go to a surgeon, they will offer surgery. If you go to a radiologist, they will offer radiation. And so I think it's knowing that that's their area of specialty, but then asking the question that goes beyond that. What if I don't do this? What do you see happening? And really just being able to have honest conversations with healthcare providers and family members.
Right.
And yourself.
Yeah. And it seems like we live in an age now where I think about older people I know who sometimes struggle to have frank conversations with their physician because they tend to see their physician as way up on a pedestal and they know best. And I think we're living in an age now where more frank interchange between patient and physician doesn't always happen, but is much more likely to happen than it was maybe 40 years ago.
I agree. I think as the baby boomers age, they will be asking more questions.
Right.
And that's
right.
Okay.
Yeah, and not afraid to ask those questions. I want to make sure that we can take a couple of minutes to talk about something that I know you're very excited about, which is something of an outreach for girls who face some difficulty in terms of bereavement and so on. This Creative Reflections project involving art. Tell us about that.
Well, I would first like to begin to say that about bereavement is a huge part of hospice to begin with. We stay in touch with the family for the first 13 months following the loss of their loved one. That's during support groups, one-on-one, letters, notes, phone calls, whatever are the wishes of that family member to help them through that grieving process. But what we've found is there's a big gap in the community for our children, our youth in the grieving process, whether it's a sibling or a parent or even a grandparent that they're very close with. It's very difficult for them, and there isn't a lot of support for that. And so our wonderful art counselor developed this program, Creative Reflections, for teen and tween girls. It'll start this Thursday night, actually. So if you're interested, give hospice a call. But what it does will allow these girls the opportunity through art and doing these projects to express themselves. and ideally help them get through their grief. It is geared towards girls now because through the generosity of the Susan B. Anthony grant that we received, the projects need to be geared towards women, girls. But our goal will be that we open this up to teenage boys and girls and continue this program on.
So this would be girls at what point in this process?
That have lost a loved one.
Okay.
And they are trying to get through, you know, the stages of grieving. So we went through high school counselors, all the high schools here in Kenosha and out in the county and Racine as well, to say, you know, if you know of anyone. And sent our program things out to them so that they'd be able to share that information to get to those students who need it.
Interesting. Well, what an interesting opportunity for somebody to try to deal with their own grief and bereavement and maybe express it and get a few questions answered and along the way and maybe have their pain assuaged in some way. In the meantime, of course, we want to remind everybody about the screening this Thursday evening of this Frontline documentary called Being Mortal, based on the new book by a doctor by the name of Atal Gawande. And so that will be 6:30 Thursday evening at the Kenosha Public Museum. And it looks like a Q&A is going to follow the screening. So it's a great opportunity for people to learn still more about hospice. I know you have a lovely website, and I suppose that's the very best way to find out still more information. And for somebody who finds themselves in a situation where they think hospice care is something they need to be thinking about seriously for them or a loved one, should they just be picking up the phone and calling?
Yes, or please do. It does not have to come through a physician. We take family referrals. Patients have referred themselves. So just call us. We'll come out, meet at your home, talk to you, see if you're at the point. You know, Medicare has criteria for admission to hospice. We can't get around that. But we can talk to you about where you're at in that process, if you'd be eligible for admission. And then if not, we check in with you every few weeks just to see how you're doing. So don't wait for the physician to refer you. If you feel, if you've had more than two admissions to the hospital for the same diagnosis in the last year, call us. Maybe we can help you in the palliative care aspect long before you need hospice.
Very good. Rita Hagen is Executive Director of the Hospice Alliance and Christy Barfield, Education Manager there. I'm so grateful to both of you for taking the time to have this conversation with me, and certainly I'm grateful for the huge difference that you've made in so many people's lives. Among many, I can think of a dear faculty colleague of mine at Carthage who lost his wife some years ago. I visited her at your hospice house actually just a couple of hours before she died, but I was so impressed and was really touched by all he shared about the difference that you and your staff made in his life, and especially in the life of his wife as she neared the end of life. So we wish all of you the very best with all that you offer to our community, and I thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'll be speaking with three different people who have lived through Hurricane Harvey, all of them with connections to Southeast Wisconsin. Kurt Oyen, who was for a number of years the technical director at the Racine Theater Guild, but now has returned to his home state of Texas and lives and teaches in a suburb of Houston. We speak also to two Carthage graduates, both former VOI students of mine, both people who live in Houston. One of them forced to evacuate, and one of them who did heroic service in rescuing over 100 people from their homes in the wake of that devastation. We'll hear all three of those conversations on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org.